Coming up on today's show,
I have found that there are a lot of characteristics that artists have in common. Imposter syndrome, lack of organization or struggling with organization, procrastination, getting caught up in the process, a lot of it having to do with self-image and self-worth.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, proud member of the Recording Academy, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on location in Las Vegas, my guest has had a long career in the music industry, having started off as a musician and songwriter in San Francisco, where he played in several new wave bands and started learning production. He went on to work in Los Angeles at Cherokee Studios and Paramount before becoming an indie producer and moving to Germany, where he was signed to BMG as a producer and also ran a small indie record label. He also did artist relations for Shure throughout all of Europe before moving back to LA and working for Tascam. He later started his own PR/marketing company and present day is the chair of AES Los Angeles, host of Insights in Sound, co-founder of Artist Brain Collective, and an adjunct professor at UNLV. You have been hearing a song called Attack on Sanctuary by the German band Unknown Pleasure. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Daniel Keller.
Hi there. I don't know how to follow all that introduction. It's like my entire life in three sentences.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I know this has been a crazy, crazy couple of weeks for you.
Big time, yeah.
Let's get started by having you talk about the song that was just playing called Attack on Sanctuary. What is your connection to that band and that song?
It's one of a great many bands that one of my A&R guys at BMG Music sent me. They were absolutely one of my favorite productions. It was a band from an area of Germany that is known as the Ruhrgebiet, which is basically the Rust Belt. Mm. Very similar to the Rust Belt that we have here in the U.S. It was, it had been a very, very vibrant shipping area. And in the 90s, which is when we did that track, the area was on sort of a decline, shall we say? Mm-hmm. So things like that tend to really create interesting art scenes. You know?
You did what with that track? Your involvement was what?
Actually, that particular track, I only produced and engineered. I did not play anything on the track or anything like that because the band were truly not only self-contained, but absolutely freaking brilliant.
But I like how you say, I only produced and engineered it, as though you stood outside in the hallway and looked through the window while they recorded
it.
Yeah,
I waved at them.
Produced and engineered
is
a lot.
I waved at them, there are some bands and artists who come to you with less of an idea and less of an identity than others. And that, to my mind, is one of the roles of a producer, is to basically work with the artist to figure out what their identity is, who they are. In this particular band, the singer, who is also the songwriter, she's still around. She's actually a performer. I think last time I talked to her, she was living in Berlin. She's absolutely brilliant. Her name is Sam Lee Brown, and she is just one of the most phenomenal singers and songwriters I have worked with. And what can I say about her? You can hear it in her voice. She's brilliant. That particular song, we worked a lot on that song because it's a very personal song to her. I know that. And we really wanted to get a certain mood out of it, which we did. I think we accomplished that a lot.
But when you say producers can and should, or at least maybe did back then, help a band find their identity, etc., was that the case
First of all,
when Unknown Pleasure came to you?
Yeah, first of all, not just then, always, since time immemorial. That, to my mind, is part of a producer's job. If I'm producing a band, one of the most important aspects of that to me is, who are you as an artist? Why do I want to listen to you? Why do you want to listen to you? Why does anyone want to listen to you? And that is really, to me, that's the most important thing about being an artist. Art is to communicate. That's the purpose of art, and especially if something like music, which, you know, in this particular case, we have you have both lyrical and musical content. We want to talk to the artist about who they are, about what it is they represent, about what they want to do as artists. This particular band, I would say, Sam, as the singer, definitely had a strong, strong personality, and she really, really did and does know who she is as an artist. She's been through, as with a lot of artists, she's been through a number of different, shall I say, musical incarnations over her career. And that, to me, is the mark of a brilliant artist, if they can reinvent themselves all the time. And she is definitely, she's a well-educated musician. She does a lot of jazz. She does a lot of kind of fusion music. And she's done hip-hop. She's done all sorts of different types of music. And her voice is just, I mean, her voice, to me, does one of the things. There's a certain, there's a number of boxes that I like to tick with artists that work with me. And one of them is, does it, I call it the hair on your arms factor, right? Makes the hairs on my arms stand up. And her voice is that brilliant. And so we did a whole album with her.
But I want to go back to the producer conversation, because I think in my head, I was holding myself back, because in my head, I was picturing the artist that comes in with a chip on their shoulder and says, just produce the music. We have our identity. We don't need you to do that. We know who we are. It's kind of like they're patting you on the head. Run along, son.
Well,
just
what
produce
do they need
us.
Me for? What do they need a producer for if that's the case? If they feel that way, theoretically at least, they don't need a producer. I disagree with that principle. I don't think that, to me, if an artist comes to any producer, they're coming to a producer for an objective viewpoint on their music. That's a big part of what I do with an artist, is I am looking at their stuff as, you know, look, if you're an artist, you're inside your content all the time. You're deep inside it. You don't have the same perspective that I or some external person coming to the music is going to have. So part of what I'm doing with that artist all the time is saying, let me take that objective look at your music. Let me break it down. Let me look at you and your musical statements, shall we say, and say, you know, what is it that you're trying to say? Because they don't have that perspective. If they did, they wouldn't need a producer. And the truth of the matter is, there are a rare few artists who can self-produce. You know, Prince, or, you know, I think Todd Rundgren did a great job of producing his own stuff. But for the most part, you know, I mean, okay, Brian Wilson, another one. Great, great producer slash artist. But for the most part, most artists benefit from having a producer who comes in as an objective third party, fifth Beatle, whatever you want to call it, right? And looks at their art and says, okay, you know, here are some suggestions. They don't have to take all of those suggestions. Mm. They don't have to do everything that I suggest. And in fact, I think it's really healthy to have a situation where there's a little bit of push-pull.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I really don't mind. If they want to fight me on something, that's great.
Yeah,
you know?
At least come in open-minded, because dare I say, shame on you if you are an artist that comes in and says, the setup that I did, you know, run along, just produce us. We don't need, shame on you, because you're not opening yourself up to possibilities. You don't know what you don't know. And if Daniel Keller's producing you and says, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but what if we tried Lap Steel on this song? And they go, what is that about? Let's just try it.
Well, now let me ask you a question, though. What?
No. I'm the interviewer.
Okay, you're the interviewer. Okay, but let me hypothetical something for you. If an artist is going to come in and they're going to say, just produce me, that says to me, what are your expectations? Right? Like, just produce you. there's a big difference. There's a big difference between being an engineer and being a producer.
Yep.
That's left brain versus right brain. Yeah. And in my ideal world, whenever I can, which is most of the time, I will have an engineer so that I can be the right brain. The
that's
engineer
right.
can be the left brain. That yeah. is 90% of the projects that I've done. That's what I do because I want that person being the technical person. I don't want to have to think about
yep.
that.
Yeah,
so
I like it.
In that case, there's no such thing as just produce me.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
just doesn't work that way. It's like, and let me take that one step further. Biggest, most important part of producing an artist, in my view, is pre-production.
Mm.
What that means is that before we even set foot in the studio, I'm meeting with you at least once or twice, if not more, and we are going to do things like talk about your music. Not only talk about your music, but one of the things that I do is I say, give me 5 or 10 tracks from other artists that you really, really like.
Yep.
Maybe even give me a couple that you absolutely hate. Or, you know, maybe something where I really like that except for this, right? Mm. And I'll do the same with them. Because that way, number one, I'm getting an idea of who they think they are. They might be wrong, but at least then I know what I'm dealing with, right?
Interesting.
Like your self-image may be completely off of what I think your self-image is, but I need to know that.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, I'm going to play them stuff that I like, which in some cases may be stuff that was recorded before they were born, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to play them stuff that I like to say, this is, you know, either not that I think, oh, you should sound like this, not at all.
Yeah.
I hope they're unique. But here's an aspect of something like, you know, here's a vocal style that, you know, something like that, you know, all of that stuff is going to be part of the getting to know each other phase.
Fantastic.
And then, yeah, and then we're going to break down their songs and say, you know, like, yeah, I listened to this demo that you recorded, you know. Okay, very, very famous case of this is George Martin producing the Beatles, okay? The song Can't Buy Me Love, originally when the Beatles brought it to him, it started with the verse. I'll buy you a diamond ring, my... And George Martin said, no, start with the chorus.
Wow. Wow.
Nile Rodgers is another one. Nile Rodgers is an absolutely brilliant producer. And one of the things that he said is, man, start with the chorus, you know? And it's true. You know, there's an old phrase, don't bore us, get to the chorus, right? You know, it's like the chorus better kick ass. And if it doesn't, then there's something wrong with the song. So to my mind, you know, I want to analyze the song. I want to break down the song with them before we record.
Wow.
I want to know where we're going. Not that I think we're going to know everything about it, but you need a roadmap.
Yeah.
You know?
This is great stuff. Folks, thanks. This has been this week's episode. You just got a masterclass in producing from Daniel Keller. Oh my gosh. What a great start. What a great start.
That was easy.
As the audience can hear from the intro, you've had quite the career, so there is plenty to cover. Let's start at the logical place, the beginning. You started in San Francisco as a performing musician and songwriter and played in several new wave bands, not to mention started to learn production as well. Does that seem like a lifetime ago? But at the same time, were there lessons that you learned then? And maybe they were just practical lessons that you still draw from today?
Oh, that's a compound question if there ever was one. Actually, I started even earlier than that. I started as a teenager playing guitar and writing songs and stuff like that. But when I lived in San Francisco, I definitely got into playing with other people, which I think is really, really important to creativity. Working with other people, you know, a lot of younger people make music on their own. And I definitely started out playing in bands where you're interacting with each other, with other musicians. And I actually started out playing more, I would say, acoustic music and stuff like that. But it was just the dawning of what you would call the punk and new wave era.
Mm.
And so I wasn't hardcore enough to be a punk, and I didn't like all the spitting. So, you know, I gravitated toward the skinny tie bands, as we used to call them. And I played around in a lot of clubs there, and I went into the studio with each of my bands. And every time I went into the studio, I was very enamored with the technology, the process, the process of multi-tracking, the process of recording. The very first time I stepped into a vocal booth, and I stood in front of a very expensive Neumann microphone. I had the headphones on. I slipped my hands into my pockets, and I could hear my hands going into my pockets. And I leaned into the microphone, and I said, I can hear the dates of the dimes in my pockets. And I was really enamored with that whole process, right? And after that, I decided, yeah, I really wanted to get into the recording process. I went out. In those days, we didn't have the internet, and so I went out to, I grabbed the local recycler paper, and I found a guy who was selling a four-track reel-to-reel, a TAC 3340. And I went over to his place, and he played me all this great stuff that he had done with acoustic guitars, overdubbing them and stuff. And I thought, oh, okay. And I forked over my money, and I carried this thing back to my apartment.
And you might have been how old?
I was early 20s.
Okay.
And
brought it back to your apartment.
And then I got there, and I said, oh, shit, I need a mixer. And so I had to go out. I had to look up the local Pro Audio dealer, and I went down there, and I bought a little mixer. And he upsold me and sold me a microphone and sold me a digital delay unit, right? A Delta Lab Effectron. And I, you know, I didn't have a reverb or anything like that, but I had the spring reverb in my amp head. And it just, you know, it started what has since been a bottomless pit of, you know, buying stuff all the time. And I just started learning about overdubbing and learning about how to create different sounds. I got myself a drum machine.
Wow.
Got myself various other bits and pieces. Bought my first synthesizer, which was a Sequential Circuits Pro 1.
25 words or less. How are you paying for all this? What were you? Was this music money, or did you have a job on the side?
I had various jobs on the side. I had little jobs on the side. I also had a little bit of a technical background, and for a short time, I had a job working for the phone company. You know, I have always been just doing a few odd jobs here and there. I've had a very eclectic career, so at that point, then I just started learning stuff.
So you moved to Los Angeles, and your first studio job was Cherokee Studios. Then you went on to Paramount. What was the impetus for the move to Los Angeles, and how were you fortunate enough to get those jobs that you had there?
Okay, so the impetus was after about my fifth or sixth band in San Francisco, playing in clubs, really enjoying it, but not feeling like that was going to be the future for me as a rock star. I wanted to get a job in the studios. There were not that many studios in San Francisco, and it was kind of a little bit of a closed scene. I mean, you could have gotten a job there, I suppose, but I didn't have any luck pounding the pavement there. And I just turned around one day, I quit my job at the phone company, and I said, hey, I'm going down to L.A. I'm going to work in the studios.
So not the traditional, I'm going to L.A. because I want to be a rock star. It was because I want to work in the studios.
I wanted to work in the studios.
Wow.
I wanted to become an engineer. And, of course, when I said that to all of my musician friends in San Francisco, they all snickered and said, yeah, right, dude.
You'll be back.
Yeah, pretty much. And I moved. I loaded everything I had into a friend's pickup truck and moved down to L.A. I got myself a little rent-controlled apartment in West Hollywood, and I grabbed a copy of the Music Connection magazine, which had a listing of all the studios in town.
But you had gone there just like that, packed up everything and went, not, you know, well, I had been making several trips back and forth.
I had been to LA a number of times because bands had played there, but I knew nothing about the studio scene.
Wow.
And I just went around to all the studios that I could find and, you know, gave them my resume, and they said, yeah, see you, thanks. And then actually, the thing with Cherokee was really interesting because I was coming back from an interview at a really crummy little demo studio. I won't name it, but it was really pretty crummy. But I was, you know, I wanted to start somewhere. And I'm driving back to my little rent-controlled apartment, and I passed by a storefront that I must have passed by 100 times already. It was right on Fairfax Avenue, and there was no sign. It was just a wood-paneled front facade in front of the place and a little neon house number, and that was it. And I caught sight of it this one time, and I thought, I wonder if that's a studio. And I hung an illegal U-turn in the middle of Fairfax Avenue, and I pulled into the red zone, and I got out of my car, and I pushed the door open. And sure enough, there's records on the wall. And I see the receptionist who She's a wonderful woman. At the time, her name was Kelly Kramer. She's now Kelly Musgrove or Musgrave. I don't know. I haven't been in touch with her in a while except on social media. But Kelly was wonderful. And I said, what studio is this? And she said, Cherokee. And I said, okay, can I leave a resume? And she said, sure. I left a resume there. And literally, by the time I then drove one block up and one block over to my little apartment, there was somebody leaving a message on my answering machine.
Wow.
And he said, you know, look, I don't want somebody who's got studio experience already. I want to take somebody who I can train in, quote unquote, the Cherokee way.
Mm.
And I said, dude, I'll be right over.
Wow.
And I drove back there. He interviewed me a little bit. He found out I had a bit of a technical background because what he was looking for was kind of a combination of a tech and a second engineer.
Mm.
And I just happened to time it right. I fit the bill. And so he starts showing me around in this studio. Back then, a lot more studios were multi-room. This was a four-room studio, four of a legendary console called a Trident A-Range. There were only 17 ever made, I believe, or maybe it was 14, but there were very few. And he starts showing me around there, and he said, well, I can't take you in Studio 2 right now because Crosby, Stills, and Nash are in there, but come on in Studio 1. We're setting up for Elton John.
Whoa.
And I just, I went, oh, my God, how did I get this? And
wow.
And he said, you know, can you start Monday? And I said, sure. And he said, well, if you want to come in tonight, it was a Friday, you know, we're having a record release party for David Bowie.
Mm.
And I'm like, holy shit, I just landed, you know, in the middle of it. And yeah. I really had. This yeah. was an amazing studio.
Wow.
It was, you know, this had been the studio where some of the first Steely Dan albums were cut.
Mm.
I was fortunate enough during the time that I worked there to be a second engineer and a fly on the wall for sessions with producers like Phil Ramone and Peter Asher, Roger Basharian, who produced Squeeze and Elvis Costello.
Wow.
All sorts of really, really legendary people. And I got to watch not just how they worked technically, but how they worked psychologically with the artist.
Mm.
And that shaped a lot of my own perspective on how to work with them.
Yeah, what we heard at the beginning. Yeah. Wow. And audience, for those that want to hear some more Phil Ramone stories, if you never heard my interview with Joe Salvato, I'll put a link on the show page for Daniel's episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. And you can go back and listen to Joe tell some stories, not only about Phil Ramone, but about other people, other cool sessions that he has been a part of. Folks, this episode is coming out just 1 week before I head to Quincy, Illinois for the Inklight Festival. You have heard me mentioning it the last couple of weeks. They are calling it a literary festival of craft, cinema, and celebration to include workshops, a film festival, and an awards gala. I am going to take off my podcaster hat and do a presentation on how to partner with a publicist, which hopefully you know is my full-time role. Go to indiesunited.net, and there is a banner across the top that you can click on to go to the festival page. You will even see my picture on there as one of the speakers. Be reminded that you have an open invitation to email me via podcast@nhte.net for a mailbag segment. Tell me whatever you want to contribute, a question for me to answer, or maybe an interview you particularly enjoyed or a lesson you learned from an episode of this podcast. I will read some or all of it along with your first name and where you are located on a future episode. Daniel, let's continue doing some background setting because I think this is all making for great context as it relates to the discussion that we will have about the various projects that you're involved with today. So after Los Angeles, you moved to Germany. Similar question as to the work you got in LA. Signed to BMG as producer, ran a small indie record label, and did artist relations for Shure, covering all of Europe. Were you just a self-starter? Were you in the right place at the right time? Was it, oh my gosh, I just moved to a different continent. I've got to find some work somewhere doing something. How did you manage to not only keep landing on your feet, but landing some pretty cool jobs?
I don't know. I've never thought of myself. I guess I am a self-starter, but I'm also, I refer to myself as a lead actor in short attention span theater. I am always looking for something new. I do believe that I am probably, you know, somewhere on the spectrum, like most artists. The way that whole thing happened was, in addition to working at Cherokee and then at Paramount, I was also a songwriter and producer. I was working with a lot of other artists producing their stuff. I was writing my own stuff. And in pitching one of my own songs, I had made friends with a music publisher, who to this day is still a close friend of mine. And he at one point had asked me, he said, you know, the next time you go to Germany, my wife is German, and I've been married to her for many years, and we used to go every summer out to Germany to visit her mother. And at one point he said to me, you know, the next time you go out to Germany, you should look up this guy at MCA Universal in Munich and play him your stuff. I was like, cool, why not? You know, the hell. And I played him a couple of demos that I had done, and he said to me, it's too bad you don't live here, because if you lived here, I could get you a lot of projects. And then he mentioned, he said, and you would be the exotic foreigner. And I thought, well, you know, I could be another guy producing, you know, working my way up in L.A., or I could try something different.
Mm.
And so it turned out he was also at the same time, he was just getting ready to leave MCA and go over to BMG. And I said, you know what? This sounds like a really exciting thing. And, you know, I did have the advantage of my wife speaking German. I spoke no German whatsoever. But at the same time, I had to learn all that myself. You know, not that my wife could teach me German or anything. And I just said, you know, what the hell? Why not? You know, if I don't do this now, I may never do it.
Yeah.
And we just packed up everything. I had a fairly complex studio set up at that point, because I was definitely a nerd. I was a MIDI nerd. I had tons of synthesizers. I had a big mixing console and everything. And we just packed it all up into a shipping container, shipped it over to Germany, moved over there, and I started getting gigs from this guy. And in fact, Unknown Pleasure was one of the first bands he sent me. And I just started working with a lot of different German bands of a lot of different genres. I was mostly, and still am, mostly attuned to, I guess, what you would call indie rock, you know, and singer-songwriters and people like that. And so this was just, you know, it wasn't the mainstream musical scene in L.A., in the States. It was not the mainstream musical scene in Germany either, but that's where I live.
Yeah.
And I ended up there. And I really, you know, he was right. I started getting gigs because I had the quote unquote American sound. To this day, I don't know exactly what that means, but I was an American guy. I was over there. A lot of people wanted to work with me because I wasn't just another German dude.
I see.
Same way, a lot of people want to work with you here if you're British or whatever, you know, so it just worked out that way.
Well, so then regarding moving back to the States, did you relocate to Los Angeles and then found the Tascam job, or did you get the Tascam job and say, well, I guess I'm moving back to America? And by the way, you were designing control surfaces for them. Am I missing something here? That seems completely out of left field given the jobs that you had up to that point.
Well, let me give you a little bit of context. While I was in Germany, prior to that, as I said, I was a complete equipment geek.
Yeah.
Always have been. I like certain aspects of technical stuff. I built, you know, what I would call the MIDI rig from hell, you know, just like tons and tons of keyboards locked to a tape machine, et cetera, et cetera. And while I was in Germany, I, at one point, I was actually on the streetcar headed to my studio one day, and I had a guitar with me, and just a couple of guys struck up a conversation with me, and it turned out they worked for Steinberg. And they asked me if I wanted to become a beta test site for what was then the brand new Cubase VST, which was, this was right around the mid-90s, and technology was moving from MIDI and tape to what we now have, the DAW, the digital audio workstation. So they were, that was one of the first programs where audio was integrated into the whole work surface, the whole working chain, so to speak. And so I already had, at that point, when I moved back, some familiarity with this. And in fact, the reason we moved back was because this was around the late 90s. The bottom had started to fall out of the record industry. We had a little independent label, myself and an engineer that I worked with. We had a little independent record label. We had put out a few records. We had distribution through Warner Elektra in Europe. And we had put out, I'd say, about half a dozen albums from different bands, projects that we had worked on, because that was my thing. I would go out to the clubs, I would find an artist or a band, and I would bring them into the studio. And we had put out a bunch of records. The bottom started falling out of the record industry. At the same time, I was also doing artist relations for Shure Microphones, and the bottom started falling out of the tech industry as well. So the timing was such that I just turned to my wife one day and said, you know, maybe it's time to go back. We had a one-year-old daughter. And so we actually made the conscious decision to move back to the U.S. And when we did, I started looking for work. I was immediately approached at a trade show by people from Tascam.
I see.
They actually wanted to hire me but didn't have a job for me. And so it's actually really funny because this guy said to me, he said, "Do you know anything about doing websites?" And I said, "No, dude, not a clue." And he said, "Well, you know, I need to come up with a job position for you. So go over to Borders Books and buy a bunch of books on HTML and learn how to make a website because you're going to be our webmaster."
Oh, my gosh.
And this was, you know, sort of the early, the nascent days of the internet, too. So I was like, okay, cool. So I started learning how to build websites. And I was hired as the title was webmaster / product specialist. And I rebuilt their website. That took a couple of months. And then after I had gotten done with that, I was sitting in a meeting with all, you know, the whole crew. And they're going through, the CEO of the company is going through, like, the product plan for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, okay, does anybody on the team here know anything about computers? And this was one of those things where old alligator mouth here had mentioned to people that I had done all the Cubase stuff. And so it was kind of like, you know, will the volunteer step forward and everybody else steps back, right? And so somebody mentioned, "Daniel, didn't you, you know, Steinberg, Cubase?" So he looks at me, wonderful guy named Gene Jolly. We're still friends. He's retired, I believe, in somewhere in New England now. But Gene looked over at me and said, "Okay, you're the new guy for the control surfaces."
I see.
So Gene basically appointed me as the guy for the control surfaces. We had a number of teams that worked on these control surfaces, but basically my job was to contact every digital audio workstation manufacturer and get them to build their hooks into their program so that our control surface would work with their stuff. So that became my new gig for the next,
wow,
like 2 years. Wow. I was helping to design and implement those control surfaces. And that turned into basically, you know, pretty much all that I did at Tascam for a couple of years.
Yeah, because I mentioned this back in the intro, you started your own PR/marketing firm. Why do you say that happened accidentally?
Everything in my career has been accidental, man. What happened was, during the course of creating the control surfaces, I was doing all the documentation, etc. And it ended up that I ended up also writing a lot of the marketing materials.
Mm.
Now, when I was downsized from Tascam, which was great, it was perfect timing for me because I was kind of burning out on corporate life. Mm. It was over 2 years in this job, and I'm not the corporate type at all. And TEC Tascam was a big corporation at that point. I was asked, I stepped away voluntarily. They said, you know, we want to downsize. And I said, okay, you know, I'm cool. I can leave. And I had written the marketing copy for these products. I had written the manuals, technical docs, and everything. And about 2 or 3 days after leaving the company, I'm just kind of sitting around trying to figure out what my next move is. I have 2 kids and a house payment and all that. And a guy calls me up and says, it's actually my former boss, calls me up and says, "I'm supposed to write this article for Electronic Musician Magazine, and my heart's really not in it, and I thought of you because I think you're a really good writer." And I said, "I am? Okay, cool." And I wrote the article. The editor of the magazine, Steve Oppenheimer, really liked it, kept hiring me to do more articles.
Mm.
And then a friend of mine sent me a book. It was called The Well-Fed Writer, and it was about doing commercial freelance writing. And I devoured that book and said, okay, cool, I'm going to do that. And so I took the exhibitor list from whatever the most recent trade show I had been at was, and I started sending out cold call solicitation emails.
Oh my gosh.
Saying, I'm a writer. Do you need anybody? And I think I sent out 2,500 emails. I got four responses.
Oh.
Two of them were no. One of them was, well, are you just a writer or are you a PR company? And idiot me, I said, oh, I'm a writer. Like, oh, okay, that was the wrong answer. And then the last one, they basically said, because I didn't even know what I was doing at that point. Mm-hmm. And then the last one, they hired me. That was a little company at the time called Biamp. And they hired me to do some copy for them and a few other things. And then I'm walking through a trade show and somebody from Mackie is introduced to me. And he literally stops in the aisle, bends down and starts bowing to me and says, you know, you were artist relations for Shure Microphones, and we have modeled our entire artist relations program on what you guys did over there.
Whoa.
And they hired me as a client as well.
Whoa.
I started getting some really great PR clients. And so all of a sudden, I had a company. Early on, I had thought of the name Get It In Writing, and I trademarked the name, and I got the website. And so I was already kind of doing business at that. And it just started snowballing. Before a couple of years, I had enough work that I was hiring other writers.
Mm.
I started hiring some of the editors that were getting laid off from magazines and whatnot.
So cool.
And 25 years later, I'm still doing a lot of that same stuff.
So
I did start branching out into, I discovered a love of doing video early on.
Mm-hmm.
Started branching out into that, doing a lot of content for companies. And I still do a lot of that. I do a lot of it now for individuals, startups. I also, over the years, have gotten pretty good with business consulting and whatnot. I do mergers and acquisition stuff. I do a lot of coaching of businesses, younger companies. The same way I've done it with artists, I do this now with businesses. You know, what's your brand and, and how to understand your brand awareness and stuff like that.
I love
it. I've been involved in the launches of, you know, a number of products like the Avid Venue console and a couple of other products for DigiDesign, products for Zildjian. You know, over the years, just a lot of different things that sort of came my way. And yeah, to answer your question in a very roundabout way, I am what they call an autodidact. I am self-taught at everything I've ever done.
Mm.
I have no formal education in writing or anything like that, and yet I just kind of figure it out as
amazing.
I go along.
Amazing.
So that's what I did with all of it.
I am joined today on location in Las Vegas by Chair of the Audio Engineering Society of Los Angeles, host of Insights in Sound, co-founder of Artist Brain Collective, and adjunct professor at UNLV, Daniel Keller. Stick around because we will be talking about those various endeavors. Visit his official website at daniellistonkeller.com. I will have a link for it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. At the bottom of his website, you will see logos, links for Facebook and Instagram for his show, Insights in Sound. You can go to Daniel's official YouTube channel, which has a combined total of almost 1.9 million video views. Plus, it is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the usual podcast platforms. There is also a page on his website for Artist Brain Collective, which you will hear about shortly. Earlier, I was saying that I will be in Quincy, Illinois next week. That being said, since I say regularly on this show that I would love to meet listeners of Now Hear This Entertainment to say a face-to-face thank you for listening to the podcast each week, I do realize that I cannot be everywhere. And so in an effort to connect with audience members in locations I will not get to, I invite you to join me online for a virtual coffee on my podcast website, nhte.net. There is a bright yellow Buy Me a Coffee button that will allow you to do exactly that. Well, you can buy more than one if you're so inclined. You will see others before you who have done so. The messages that they have written to me there, as well as the replies that I posted back to them. It's a nice way for you to let me know that you appreciate the work that I am doing with this show every week, every month, well over 12 years now. Daniel, let's start digging into these various current projects of yours that I've been alluding to. For starters, we are actually sitting in the Thomas Beam Music Center building on the UNLV campus. I said back in the intro that you are an adjunct professor, but what specifically are you teaching and How have you found this role to be meaning for someone who has done so, so much in music over the years? Once again, this feels like something, dare I say, new for you.
Yes and no. I've always taught. I've always been something of an educator. So this is not really that new. However, a lot of what I've done this is sort of the culmination of a lot of what I've done. And essentially, I sort of fell into this too. I've backed into almost everything in my career, but a friend came to me and said, you know, you should meet this person who is teaching here. And Sam and I connected, and Sam just, you know, we both agreed that I would be really a good fit for this program. This is a fairly new program in that it's been around for a while, but they've only recently gotten their accreditation as a 4-year bachelor's course.
I see.
But to answer your question specifically, this semester I've been teaching advanced audio production. And what that means essentially is I'm not going to teach you Pro Tools. By the time you get to me, you should know it. What I'm teaching them is, I like to joke and say I teach them how to keep their mouth shut and when to, but essentially I teach them how to work with the artist. I teach them all the stuff that I learned watching all of these other people at Cherokee, at Paramount, and, you know, just watching how the producer works with the artist. That's the stuff I teach them.
You teach that in a classroom environment or in a studio environment?
All of the above.
Okay.
The classroom is the studio. The studio is the classroom. Their projects with me basically involve bringing in an artist and working with them and doing a complete recording.
Wow.
That's the whole course.
Wow.
That is the main thing they do is I tell them you're going to do a project from soup to nuts. You're going to find the artist. We bring them in here for pre-production meetings. Then we get out there. You set up the microphones. You run the session. You mix the session, etc.
Wow, that's fantastic, because in my head, when I said a classroom environment, I was picturing a lecture where Daniel's standing up at the board and everyone's sitting in their desk and there's a book you have to buy for the class.
No.
Yawn.
Oh, gosh, no. We work right in this room. And this is how we've done it, and this is what I will continue to do for this particular course.
Okay.
I'm going to be taking on some, and I'm actually building other courses here as well. We're going to be starting an internship program here where we place the students in job situations. Lots of opportunities here, of course, in live production. I'm also going to be teaching a video production course because I do a lot of work as a videographer. And there's a few other things that we're talking about as well. So there will be a lot of other opportunities here.
So good. One of the other hats you do wear is as chair of the Audio Engineering Society of Los Angeles. You and I know what AES is, but for those who don't, talk about that organization, because you oversee the LA chapter, meaning by no means is this a group that's exclusive to Southern California. AES, they're not even just national, they're international.
They're global, yes. And the Audio Engineering Society has been around for, decades and decades. And it is an association of exactly what it says, audio engineers. I like to joke and say that a lot of the people that I work with have a much bigger pocket protector than I do. But I know enough, and I fulfill certain functions. One of the functions that I fulfill as the chair is I create events. So every month we have an event, whether it be a tour of a studio or a panel discussion, or last month we did a tour of Disney Symphony Hall in Los Angeles. I create different events every month. I do have a team, an executive committee that I work with, and we all contribute to this. But a lot of this is stuff that I guess that's one of the things I'm good at. I'm good at coordinating things. I'm a good social director, you know. So I put together a lot of these events. We promote these events. We invite people who belong to the Audio Engineering Society to join us at these events. We use these events to promote membership in the AES. So we say, you know, if you want to be an AES member, you have access to these kind of events.
But what if someone's listening to our interview and there's an AES chapter near them and they say, I'm not an engineer, but gosh, if they're doing events like that in my area, I'm a musician. I'd love to go to one of those. Or is it, no, you're an engineer or you're not coming?
Actually, you don't have to be an engineer. You can be a student. You can know nothing at all about audio engineering and just be very focused on it and be interested in it. Absolutely. There's no criteria that says you have to be an engineer or anything like that. As far as different areas, each individual section in various geographic areas has a different way of running. Some are more active than others. I just got back from Soundcheck Expo in Mexico City. Their section there is very, very active. They have a lot of stuff going on there as well. Some of the sections are just more robust than others. The Los Angeles section, which I am chair of, is I have been working really hard to get it to be more active. And I've done, we've done a lot over the last year and a half or so to get it back up to where it was pre-COVID.
Okay.
And that's one of the edicts that I sort of came in with, was that I really wanted this organization to be more active. And so I call upon people I know in studios and in manufacturers and whatnot, and just try and have an event every month. I can't say that every section is that active, but I will say that a lot of them are.
Tell us about the Artist Brain Collective, which I think you might have started as a passion project, and I sense has become something deeply rewarding to you.
Artist Brain Collective is born out of my own understanding of the brain of an artist, which is very, I hate to use the term neurodivergent, but it's true. Most artists are somewhere on the neurodiversity spectrum. And I have found that there are a lot of characteristics that artists have in common. Imposter syndrome, lack of organization or struggling with organization, procrastination, getting caught up in the process, a lot of it having to do with self-image and self-worth. I started doing panels on stuff like this over the years, where I would talk about things like starting off your career, being thrown into the deep end, stuff like that. And I would bring in Grammy-winning, established producers who are friends of mine. And we'd all sit there, and when you hear somebody who's won 12 Grammys say, "Yeah, I struggle with imposter syndrome too," it definitely helps you as a young person to realize that it's not just you.
Yeah, for sure.
I think this is very, very valuable for younger students to see that they're not alone, that we're all the same, that we all deal with these same issues. And so I started a few years ago going around and offering workshops on this, and we've done them at, we've done them here at UNLV, we've done them at Pierce College, UCLA, the Conservatory of Recording Arts and Sciences in Phoenix, and we have a number of other schools that we're involved with. We want to start also bringing it to high schools, so it's just something that I feel is very, very valuable, especially for younger artistic types and creatives, because they just don't know that there's nothing wrong with them, that you're not broken, and so it's become definitely a passion of mine to be able to say, let me show you that we're all, we all struggle with these same things, and it's not, there's nothing wrong with you. You're going to use this as a superpower. It's going to evolve into something that is actually healthy for you.
But if someone is listening to this and says, "I really struggle with mental health, I need to go to daniellistenkeller.com and find this Artist Brain Collective page," is that good? Or is it, Bruce, mental health, depending on what this is, I'm not a licensed,
I'm not a licensed therapist. I do work with licensed therapists, and I have for a long time, and especially some of them who are very focused on musicians and artists. But I'm not a licensed therapist. However, yes, if you go to my website, you can find information about it, about the workshops that we do. We also create what I call mastermind groups, Zoom groups, where we meet, six or seven or eight of us, and we meet on a regular basis, and we just talk about, we talk about absolutely nothing, but there's this camaraderie that develops through it. There's an understanding that you're talking to other people, whether they be professionals or even younger people, there's a mix. And so they get to talk to other people. And I guess the real goal there is to normalize all of these issues so that you don't feel like you're all alone. You don't feel you're suffering.
But I like that you're offering the virtual option, because as impressive as it is to hear all these different locations where you've been able to do things in person, just like I said, I can't be everywhere. There's going to be someone in New York, there's going to be someone in Orlando, there's going to be someone in Chicago that says, "Man, I'd love to be a part of what he's doing, but I can't get to these panels." So if they can get online and sit in a mastermind,
That's been exactly why we did it that way. And a lot of times what happens is we'll do a workshop somewhere, and several people from that workshop will then sign up, and they'll tell friends who may not be there. And so it's – and actually, I mean, it's a great way also to continue the process, because if you just do one workshop, that may be really interesting for them, but, you know, the glow wears off, shall we say, you know?
Yeah.
But if you're doing it on a regular basis, like we tend to meet like every couple of weeks, you know? And so it's just like, hey, you know, Bob, what's going on with you, you know, or, or you know, Julie, what's going on with you? And people just, you know, they vent.
Yeah.
They basically just, you know, they talk about whatever's coming up for them. And it's very useful for them to hear that, oh, okay, so you went through that too?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So yeah, it's been a really, really rewarding thing.
Well, we absolutely have to talk about your show, Insights in Sound, because... Wow, close to 1.9 million combined video views on your YouTube channel alone, not to mention the audience you have found on Facebook, plus certainly those that follow the show through platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and so on. Share with my audience what you're doing on your show.
My show, it's another accidental thing, Bruce. Honestly, I mean, like I said, my entire career has been accidental.
How does one accidentally start a show?
I was having a conversation with a friend during COVID. A dear friend of mine, producer by the name of Michael Beinhorn. And Michael's, you can check him out. You can Google him. He's absolutely done amazing work over his career. And I've known him, Michael, for close to 30 years now, I would say. And we were just having this conversation over Zoom during COVID. We were both bored and we were both just kind of grousing about the music business like we always do. And at one point we had been talking for over an hour and I said, you know, it's too bad we didn't record this. And he said, yeah, you know, you really should. And so we decided that we would do it again sometime soon and I would record it.
I see.
And then at the same time, I had been having a conversation with another friend of mine, a wonderful musician named CJ Vanston. And I said, CJ, do you want to do this too? And he said, sure. And so it ended up that CJ became episode number one and Michael became episode number two. And friends just, you know, I would start reaching out to friends and say, do you want to have a conversation online? And they said, sure, because everybody was going crazy with COVID.
I see.
And so it just kind of started developing and I started doing a few more and then other people would come to me and say, hey, you know, I heard you talk to so-and-so. Can I be on your show too? Mm. And I guess it was almost about 20 episodes in before I started realizing, oh, this is a podcast, isn't it? And at the same time, I've always been doing it via video because I feel like facial expressions are very important. Mm-hmm. I like being in the same room with somebody. So I had been doing it as a video thing anyway. And it just sort of took off and kept going. And we just dropped episode number 210. And, you know, it honestly... I'm shocked when you tell me there's 1.9 million views because honestly, I've never done any promotion for it. It's all organic. It's just that I talk to people who I consider very, very well-versed in their craft. I don't talk to them about the typical stuff, you know, like fanboying out about this album or something like that. I talk about the creative process. I talk about stuff where literally almost after every episode, somebody says to me either, wow, you know, you asked me questions I'd never thought of, or, you know, something along those lines, because I just, as you see, I like to talk.
You know? And mind you, your show has grown production-wise to the point where I've seen you on location at events where you've got this elaborate backdrop, you've got three cameras. I mean, this is an important show for you. This is no longer two people that know each other for 30 years. Let's get on Zoom and I'll happen to record it.
Not at all. I mean, I do still do Zoom calls with people, although these days we've moved from Zoom to SessionWire, which I find to be a much more robust platform, and the audio quality is better. But for the most part, I would say 80% of the episodes are done live in person because I feel like, first of all, I like the vibe of being in the same room with somebody. Mm-hmm. I can use multiple cameras, and we are sponsored by a wonderful PTZ camera company called Obspot, and they provide us with really great video equipment. I have always been really conscious of the audio component. Funny about that, huh? And so, you know, I like to have somebody on a lav mic so that they get a good, you know, a good audio quality as well. And so for me, if I can shoot it live in the same room, I will. And I have a run-and-gun rig, a three-camera rig that I can take on in a flight case that I can take as carry-on on the airlines. And, you know, I'm happy to go wherever the gig is in that sense. Yeah.
We're going to close today with a song by the late Max Benham, one called Real. Before I let you go and we play that track, share with the audience all about him as well as what your role was with this song.
Max, this is actually a fairly early production done in, I guess, the early 90s before I went to Germany. Max was a really brilliant musician in San Diego. Mm. And he came to me as part of a songwriting group that just, you know, they were pitching songs and I was the producer and I really liked his voice. I liked his style. And Max actually was, he was a singer-songwriter. He played guitar. And so one of the things that I did with Max was he came in, I said, I'm going to give you a click track. You're going to play the song and sing it, and that's it. And then he left, went back to San Diego, and I laid down all the other instruments. The sax is somebody else.
Okay.
Everything else is me, and I just played, you know, multi-tracked the whole thing.
Wow.
And then he came back and redid the vocal. So all the instruments are basically me. And, you know, again, this was sort of the learning the process of production. And, again, this came out of also pre-production, meeting with Max, finding out who he was, finding out what kind of music he liked, etc. And this is the end result.
And clearly he was okay with that. He was okay with you saying, you're going to just sing, we're going to have a click track, bye-bye, go back to San Diego and I'll do the rest. There was no pushback of, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? Why are you doing all this?
There was no pushback at all from Max because I think he knew. He had heard a lot of the other stuff that I had done, and I had shown him that, you know, I'm a fairly capable multi-instrumentalist. I mean, I, you know, play guitar and bass. My bass is my main instrument, but I played a lot of other stuff there. And again, you know, I also knew enough to know what I couldn't do well. Mm. So I brought in a sax player because my sax chops are just not that good. but for the most part, everything else, I just, you know, I can fake it enough on an instrument to get a good result. And I knew what I wanted to hear. And he knew what he wanted to hear. And ultimately, I will say this. For me, the most important aspect of things is always the song. It's always about the song. He gave me a song here that I felt really just, it epitomized, you know, a really great song structure. We worked on a lot of that stuff together, and then he just left me to my devices, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, and I can tell that you obviously felt strongly about the song because here it is all these years later, and you're talking about what you and he did together as though it was last week and not decades ago.
Because I still, to this day, do the same thing with an artist. I will come with an artist, and I will say, what does the song need? Mm. Who are you as an artist, and what are you trying to say? And that's what this song was, and it represents that well.
We've come full circle. Like I said, we started off with basically a producer masterclass and closed on a great note. This has been amazing. It was long overdue. We've known each other for more than 9 years, and I'm so glad that we finally got you. I'm now here at this entertainment. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you hosting me here in these facilities.
Thank you, Bruce. I'm really glad we got to do this, too. It's been, as you say, it's high time, so glad we finally made it happen, man. Absolutely.
Audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to creator, presenter, moderator, host, producer, videographer, composer, digital marketing strategist, artist, musician, educator, and communicator, Daniel Keller. Again, do visit his official website at daniellistonkeller.com. As I mentioned earlier, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. You just heard him talking about his show, Insights in Sound. Go to the Daniel Liston Keller channel on YouTube to watch it there. Remember that at the bottom of his website, there are links to engage via Facebook and Instagram, including a strong presence for his Insights in Sound on those. Plus, of course, find his show through traditional podcast platforms such as Apple Podcasts and Spotify, etc. He also talked about Artist Brain Collective. You will find information on that on daniellistonkeller.com as well. Let Daniel know that you heard him and now hear this entertainment. That will do it for episode 641. Thanks ever so much for listening. I will send you out today with a song from Max Benham. This is the one that Daniel just talked about. It's called Real.